Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Amy Welburn. Amy is the author of numerous books, including A Catholic Woman's Book of Days and Come Meet Jesus, an invitation from Pope Benedict XVI. With Amy Welburn, we begin a very special edition of Inside the Pages, exploring the life and works of Flannery O'Connor. Flannery O'Connor discovered intimations of divinity, not in the lives of saints, but in wickedly funny tales of human misfits who, through peculiar and often violent turns of events, run up against the limits of worldly wisdom. Flannery O'Connor is the author of two novels, Wise Blood and The Violent Barred Away. Her short story collections include A Good Man is Hard to Find and Everything That Rises Must Converge. She's also the author of numerous essays and 259 witty, spirited, and revealing letters that have been published in the collected works. Flannery O'Connor has a distinctive voice as a spiritual writer. She covers topics as Christian realism, the church, the revelation between faith and art, sin and grace, and the role of suffering in the life of the Christian. She is a spiritual master who should not be missed. With Amy Welburn, we begin our discussion of the life and work of Flannery O'Connor. Amy, it's so good to have you here today.
Oh, it's great to be here again. Thanks.
We're turning to you to help us understand this very, very important woman and the contribution that she has offered not only to Catholics, but to all readers of good literature all over. How did you get to know Flannery O'Connor?
Well, you know, first of all, let me just say that I'm really glad that you all are doing this. You know, I think that, you know, we've gotten so wrapped up in, you know, picking out the real problems with some bad literature that we may have, you know, neglected the good literature, and so it's time to turn back to that, and I give you real props for doing this. Flannery O'Connor, I probably first read Flannery O'Connor in college, I'm not sure, but she first came to my attention in a real, you know, serious way about maybe 15 years ago when I was beginning to do some adult ed in parishes. I was a DRE, and I wanted to do a Catholic reading group, and so I sort of was looking back over at a lot of famous Catholic fiction and reintroduced myself to Flannery O'Connor and was really taken by her on a lot of levels as a Southerner. Even though I wasn't born in the South, I lived most of my life in the South, and I sort of consider that my home base as a Catholic and as a writer and as a woman. And her story is just is so intriguing and so fascinating, and I really would go out and say I think that she is a saint, personally. Mm-hmm. And her writing is different than anything we have. You know, I mean, it's difficult stuff, which we'll probably get to in a minute, but she's a writer that is considered, you know, one of the great American writers, not just of the 20th century, not just a Catholic writer, but one of the great American writers. And she's profoundly spiritual and profoundly theological. So she's somebody that we need to pay attention to.
I would agree with that 100% because, you know, I read Flannery O'Connor, let's see, it was probably at least 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. I had read Wise Blood, mm-hmm. and I didn't understand it, and I got to the ending of it, and I didn't like it.
Right.
I couldn't understand why the character was doing what he did, and the conclusion, I don't want to spoil it for right. people, but when I read the ending, I didn't get it. But now, as an adult, looking back, I began to understand why he was doing the things he was doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the key with Flannery O'Connor is, that it's after you've lived a certain amount of time, you begin to understand her characters.
Yeah, and you have to also understand where she's coming from. You mm-hmm. just can't read her cold. I mean, you can, but you end up, as you said, you know, sort of confused and maybe even not liking it. And, you know, I think one of the best ways to, you know, introduce ourselves to what she was about is to just know that one thing she said about her stories, one of her collections of stories she sent to a friend when it was in manuscript form, and this is how she introduced it. She said, 9 stories about original sin with my compliment. And
yep.
So, you know, what she is basically about is sort of laying out the landscape of human life and human reality in terms which she knew very well, mostly, you know, in the rural South, mostly populated by, you know, evangelical fundamentalist Christians and so on, but coming ultimately always to the point of God's insistence on breaking into that world, you know, and sometimes it's in startling ways because, as she said in another context, I have been convinced that in the present situation, distortion is the only way of getting people to see, which means that, you know, our way of seeing life, our way of seeing ourselves has become so messed up mm-hmm. that, you know, we don't get the point unless it is just, you know, in our face, grotesque, you know, really startling to us. And that's the sort of constant motif through O'Connor's work.
Amy, she was born in Savannah, Georgia, if I'm not mistaken, and lived most of her life in Middlesville, Georgia, dying at a very young age, only 39 years old. When you think of the suffering that she went through, her illnesses, and dying so young, the contribution that she's provided for us in her works is extraordinary.
She published two collections of short stories, and there were others that were not collected in those. The Library of America has published her complete work in one of its black-bound volumes, Classic American Writing, plus those two novels. And in addition, I would highly recommend her letters, her collected letters, which are collected in a volume called The Habit of Being.
Mm-hmm.
They were edited by Sally Fitzgerald, who was her longtime friend. There's some interesting connections there. Flannery O'Connor was very good friends with Sally and Robert Fitzgerald. Robert Fitzgerald was a classicist and translated a lot of epic Greek poetry, and she was a godmother to one of their sons named Benedict, and Benedict Fitzgerald grew up to be a Hollywood screenwriter, and he ended up writing the screenplay version of the movie of Wise Blood, but even more interesting, he wrote the screenplay to The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson. So it's a sort of an interesting connection there, particularly since Gibson's Passion of the Christ was criticized by some as being excessively violent and all of that kind of thing, and there was a lot of discussion about the purpose of the violence in the film. A lot of the same discussions that we have about Flannery O'Connor's work, you know, Benedict Fitzgerald's godmother, so it's all very interesting.
Amy, she lived most of her life in a small town in Georgia, didn't she?
Yeah, Millersville, Georgia is about, I'd say, 30 miles east of Macon.
Have you been there?
Oh, I've been there, I think, three times.
A couple pilgrimages, would you say?
It really is like a pilgrimage. She was born, in the first part of her life, she lived downtown in the family home, a very big antebellum mansion. And then when she returned, she went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop for graduate school and tried to get a start in the Northeast writing, but then she was diagnosed with lupus and had to come home. Lupus was also the disease that had killed her father, and so at a very young age. And so, you know, you have to think, you know, she knew what had happened to her father, and so she knew that she only had at this point maybe, you know, 15, 20 years left.
Mm.
And so she returned to Millersville to live with her mother, and they moved to a farm outside of Millersville, which is now not quite outside. There's a Walmart right next to it and all of that kind of thing, called Andalusia. And the first couple of times I went to Millersville, 10 and 12 years ago, Andalusia was not open. It was, you could sort of see it. You could peek behind a fence and catch a glimpse of the farmhouse where she very famously wrote and raised peacocks, which was one of her great loves. And finally, a foundation has been established and has worked with the family, the O'Connor and Stein family, and are in the process of restoring Andalusia, the farmhouse, and making it into a museum. And so the last time I went, you could go into the farmhouse, and her room, because she was ill, was on the ground floor. And they have it all there, and they have her typewriter and her bed and her crutches and all of that kind of thing. And, you know, I honestly felt as I stood at the door like I was, you know, in the presence of grace. You know, this is the place and this is the spot where this woman of very deep faith had struggled with her faith, had, you know, read her Thomas Aquinas for 15 minutes every night, had written her voluminous letters and written her stories, which, you know, are all about trying to help us see in a very non-prescriptive, you know, purely literary way, the passionate love of God for his children.
It must have been very hard for that young woman who wanted to go and leave the small town and to get to the bigger city and experience things, to be stricken as she was with this debilitating illness and to have to go back home to the small town down in the South.
That's right. You know, we're talking in the, you know, the early 50s, and when literary life in New York and the Northeast was very lively, you know. And so, as I said, she went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop and was going to follow the path that many young writers followed in that way, but then she was stricken. But here's the thing that I think really elevates her as a model, for me at least, is that when you read her letters, there's no hint of bitterness. There's no hint of unhappiness of about anything. Even the letters written at the very end of her life when she was hospitalized and probably knew the end was near, she is always full of good cheer. In fact, that's how she always, you know, signed off on her letters, was cheered. And she was full of good humor and, you know, interesting and funny observations about her mother and about the country people that they lived around and all of that kind of thing. You know, I think it's, to me, that's the witness of her faith, you know, not the story, but the life and the fact that she accepted the suffering, and she really saw her gift as a vocation, and she determined that with the grace of God, she was going to, you know, fulfill this vocation and answer God's call in whatever time she had left.
When I reflect on it, Amy, she really calls upon you to reorder your life, to really look hard, which the 20-year-old Chris McGregor didn't want to do. But that as you get older, life just makes you do it.
Right.
A lot of times when people look at her work, you hear the term Southern grotesque.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that say to you?
That's an outsider's term, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I really, you know, she employs startling images and startling moments in her fiction. You know, I think she has said some wry things about the term Southern grotesque herself, and I can't put my hand on them at the moment, but, you know, she would basically retort that she was just recording what she was seeing, you know,
mm-hmm.
But I think what you said, Chris, about her work almost, you know, inviting you to reexamine your life, I think that is expressed in one of her more famous and widely anthologized stories, which is A Good Man Is Hard to Find.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the climax of that story, anyone who's read it knows, is embodied in this self-serving, self-satisfied, externally religious older woman being confronted with death
mm-hmm.
by a character we only know as the Misfit, who has picked out her family to rob and kill for no reason. And the Misfit says, at the end, he says, she would have been a good woman if there'd been someone there pointing a gun at her whole life.
Wow.
And, you know, he's intended to be kind of one of those perversely prophetic figures that we see in, unintentionally prophetic figures we see in O'Connor. But again, that's a truth, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that,
mm-hmm.
You know, as the old Catholic phrase was, memento mori, remember that you will die. And that's another subtext in a lot of O'Connor's fiction, is that, you know, we are, you know, if we are confronted with reality and the choice, faith or no faith, Christ or no Christ, it does change your life. It should.
You have written that O'Connor's characters are all afflicted by pride. I think maybe when you talk about a term like grotesque, it's not so much the Misfit characters that are so obvious. It's the other characters, seeing them in their pride.
Mm-hmm.
It really changes the reader, because it leaves you very uncomfortable, because you begin to question yourself, and how would you appear in one of Flannery O'Connor's novels?
That's right. Who am I? You know, and that's a constant you know, figure, is the prideful person. And sometimes it's, you know, the intellectual who's prideful. Sometimes it's the uneducated country person. I mean, they're, you know, Flannery spares no one, because we're all, you know, in the same boat. I think another one of my favorite moments from an O'Connor story that illustrates this is from Revelation, which is another one of the widely anthologized ones, in which a woman is confronted in various ways and challenged in various ways about her pridefulness, beginning in her with a little moment in a doctor's waiting room, and it continues as she goes home and she goes home to feed the pigs. And she's there feeding the pigs, and she's thinking about this humiliation that happened to her in the doctor's waiting room. And she just starts yelling, "Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are?" And an echo comes back to her, "Who do you think you are?" Mm-hmm. And to me, that's like, mm-hmm. you know, this really subtle moment in which, you know, it all, you know, it's all laid out there for us. Who do we think we are? And the story ends with a vision of sort of the procession, the communion of saints almost, into, mm-hmm. or actually it's a purgatorial vision, that we all are sort of in the same boat. We're all in the same, you know, we're all in the same communion, all sinners, all in need of redemption.
I think she had said once that grace must wound before it can heal. I think that's, for almost all of her characters, that is the experience, if they allow that grace to enter in to help heal them.
Right. And, you know, the reason is not because, you know, God is cruel, but because mm-hmm. we are so stubborn. You know?
Right.
You know, and it's because we are so resistant to God's grace. And you're right, that happens over and over again. And that's, you know, something that we know from Christianity in general is, you know, death must occur before life.
What's really interesting about her, too, is that she gives the atheists a full hearing in her stories. I mean, she puts out exactly what their points and what they see and the hypocrisy that they see. So you could say she does have an extraordinary worldview.
Yeah, she does. I mean, it's not a black and white thing, because sometimes the worst people in her stories, quote, worst people in her stories, are those who are, you know, purported Christians, you know. And I think this brings us back to the work you raised at the beginning, which is Wise Blood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the central character, Hayes Mohtz, of Wise Blood, establishes what he calls a Church of Christ without Christ. And it's a very short novel, but it's rich and it's jam-packed and it's difficult. It's not easy just because it's short. It's difficult. But I think that Church of Christ without Christ, and what Hayes says about it and what he does with it and how it all plays out in the novel, is very timely.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's what, you know, I see, and it's what obviously she saw in the contemporary world, is sort of, we want something but we don't want it, and we don't, you know, we want to say things about ourselves and our identity, but we don't want to really, really be disciples. You know, we hold ourselves back from that. And as you pointed out at the end, we have this, I'm not going to say it either, we have this very sort of bizarre ending in which Hayes is finally able to see. And if you read the novel, you'll know that that is sort of supreme O'Connor irony.
Again, when I was younger, I didn't understand his actions.
Right.
But now that I'm older, I couldn't imagine reacting any other way.
Right.
And I think that's the beauty of Flannery O'Connor. And one of the works that you pointed out, the Library of America,
mm-hmm.
with the collected works, you also get some of the texts of talks that she would mm-hmm. give
yeah.
when she wrote about the grotesque in Southern fiction. Mm-hmm. I think it should be must read for anybody who wants to write.
Oh, yeah. And if you don't have, you know, the funds to invest in the full, you know, Library of America version, which you should anyway, I mean, there's a shorter volume that just has her lectures and writings on writing, which is called Mystery and Manners.
Mm-hmm.
And again, those are must-reads, because, you know, there's a lot of conversation today about, quote, Christian fiction and Christians in the arts and so on. And she makes the point over and over again that the Christian artist's first responsibility is to art,
mm-hmm.
not to evangelize. She says, leave the evangelism to, you know, the priests or to the preachers, but your first loyalty is to reproduce the world and your worldview and what's inside you as accurately and as artistically, you know, with as much artistic integrity as you can. And then, you know, it comes out, you know, it works out. Another thing I want to mention to me that's very, you know, one of the more moving aspects of Flannery O'Connor's life was when she was in Milledgeville, she made friends with the sisters of the Dominican Sisters of Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
And some of your listeners may or may not know, this is a religious order that was founded by the daughter of Nathaniel Hawthorne. And it has a specific ministry, which is to minister to those with incurable cancer.
mm-hmm. Started in the 19th century when there was no such thing as health insurance, particularly for the poor. They have an establishment out in Atlanta. And the nuns at one point wrote to Flannery and asked her, told her that they had a little girl who lived with them, a little girl named Marianne, who was suffering from a very disfiguring kind of cancer. It's a facial kind of thing.
Mm.
And they had written a memoir of her, of living with her and so on, and they wanted Flannery O'Connor to write an introduction to it. And so she did. She ended up, I think, rewriting a lot of the memoir itself, but she wrote an introduction to the memoir, which I think is also included in the Library of America, that is very beautiful meditation on suffering and, probably reflective of a lot of what Flannery O'Connor was feeling herself and her own spirituality. And so, I think that's just another little part of Flannery O'Connor's life that is worth knowing about and meditating on.
There are seminarians I am encountering now who are discovering her in their classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad that they're learning about her there, and they're so enthusiastic. They want her work known. I would hope that it would be must reading in any Catholic high school, or any school, actually.
Well, controversially enough, there have been a couple of dioceses that have actually banned Flannery O'Connor.
Really?
In Louisiana, because she uses the language of her culture, mm-hmm. has her characters speak as they would speak in relationship to African Americans.
Not unlike Mark Twain.
Right, exactly. Same situation, Huckleberry Finn kind of deal. I used her. A lot of people ask, where should I start?
Mm-hmm.
If I want to get into reading this woman, where should I begin? And I always say, first of all, pick up the letters. Have those sort of at your side, because what you read in the fiction can sometimes be so strange if you're not familiar with it. You want to sort of ground yourself back into who she was and her humor and down-to-earthness and all of that kind of thing. There's several stories that I think we could progress to, more intense degrees of difficulty. To me, the easiest story that she wrote is called A Temple of the Holy Ghost, in which a little girl, which many say is probably reflective of Flannery herself, a little girl who is afflicted with a visit from older cousins who strike her as very superficial, ditzy girls. And the story goes all over the place. It takes in the visit from these girls. They're flirting with a couple of Church of God boys, which is very amusing.
Mm-hmm.
Their visit to a freak show, the effect of their telling this on this little girl, they see a hermaphrodite there. And then their return of these girls to the convent school, and it ends in a Eucharistic vision, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's very accessible, I think, and it's a good place to start. And then go from there to any of the other stories. There are stories that really deal with incarnation and sacramental theology. Parker's Back, in which a man gets a tattoo of on his back, a religious tattoo on his back, and enrages his wife. Because
mm-hmm.
of this. And that's intended to help us see at some level, at a subtle level, what Catholic sacramental theology is about. The River is an absolutely heartbreaking story, but it's
mm-hmm.
ultimately about baptism, if you can see it that way. And then any of the other stories that we mentioned. But do read them in conjunction with the letters.
Again, you can get the short stories in anthologies all over. They're easy. And then I would agree with you. You move up to the novels.
Right.
But and just reading the letters, too, you get to know where she's coming from so that when you do read the novels, there is such a richness to it then.
Mm-hmm.
And she is deeply sacramental.
She's deeply sacramental. And, some of the most interesting letters in the collection are letters to a friend who, when the letters were first published, remained anonymous. She's
mm-hmm.
known as A. She was a woman who just happened to write Flannery, a woman who lived in Atlanta who happened to write Flannery. And they struck up a correspondence. And over the course of this correspondence, A converted to Catholicism and then eventually left,
mm-hmm.
all in the course of their correspondence. And so you have Flannery's side of it, in which she's explaining the Catholic faith to A and then sort of commiserating with her as A drifts away from the faith in a very sad way. And so, those are really interesting. And the other thing about the letters is that they're funny.
Mm-hmm.
Flannery O'Connor was a very, very funny woman, very witty, very, with just this precise vision that could just pick out, the ironies of life and the know, on all of that kind of thing. And so they're wonderful, wonderful spiritual reading.
And she gave great insight on two novelists anyway, that the great novels we get in the future are not going to be those that the public thinks it wants or those that critics demand. And she really calls you to write from yourself and write the kind of novels that you want. And I think you've always done that kind of, haven't you, really, Amy, in a lot of the stuff that you've done?
Well, yeah. And I, you know, as I really try to write more fiction, which I'm trying to do now, it's a continuing challenge because all of us want to be successful, but we also want to be authentic, too. And she, you know, talks about that. I mean, she wanted to make money from her fiction. She did. And she had to make money because she was, you know, supporting her mother. You know, they had the farm, but she was supporting her mother, and she was sick, and she needed the money. And so that's really why she did a lot of the talk she did. And she was very honest about this, too. You know, she was sick. She didn't want to go out, but it was basically easy money.
Right.
And she had to do it. And she was very, you know, concerned about her rights as a published author and all of that kind of thing. But at the same time, she, you know, she wrote out of total integrity, you know, because if you're not doing that, why bother?
Well, if you can begin with Flannery O'Connor and you begin even with the letters, you'll never look at certain authors the same way again. You won't be able to read a Dan Brown, or because it's just such pablum compared to a Walker Percy or to a Richard Russo. You won't. You just can't.
Right. You know, with somebody like Flannery O'Connor, to find somebody to read with you, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because she's very discussion-worthy, and especially if there's stuff you don't get in it and you don't understand, and there's levels of meaning in it. You know, it's not like a, you know, a diagram. It's not A means B or anything like that. It's like any form of literature. And it's, you know, it's fun to hash over and to talk about these.
Absolutely. Amy, thank you so much for joining us. It's just been phenomenal to be able to talk about the life and the work of this master spiritual writer, as well as one of the great American authors, Flannery O'Connor. And I look forward to talking with you again soon. But I'm very blessed, like many of us, to be able to go out to your blog site, Charlotte Was Both. That way we can continue to keep up on all the work that you're providing for us. Again, Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you. I look forward to it, too.
With author Amy Welborn, we've gone inside the pages of the works of Flannery O'Connor. Flannery O'Connor's collected works can be found in a volume published by the Library of America. Her spiritual writings have also been published by Orbis Books under their Modern Spiritual Masters series. Amy Welborn's books, as well as her collected writings, can be found at her blog site, Charlotte Was Both. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights, today's most compelling author.